Our speaker tonight, we're super excited to have him. Bertram Chan is currently the Director of Product at EA. He has a ton of experience working as a product manager, and I don't want to step on your toes, so Bertram, I'll let you do an intro to yourself as well.
Sure.
But thank you so much for coming out tonight.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me, guys. Thanks very much. As Laura mentioned, so I'm Senior Director of Product, Head of Product Management Team for our data platform. So that's the team that actually handles and builds out all the infrastructure to do all of our player behavioral data. So anything from logging in to scoring a goal in FIFA, scoring a touchdown in Madden, all of that data, we work with the game teams to define what that is semantically, ingest it, store it, process it, make it available for analysts, make it available for marketers, and then also build data science, machine learning, et cetera, tools around it. So, I mean, the goal tonight is to understand and really talk about, okay, at a high level conceptually, as an introduction, what does all that entail? Right. But first, I'd actually like to get a show of hands. I mean, how many people right now are active product managers? Okay. How many people are engineers? Analysts? Interested folks? Okay, got it. So this is, you know, a high level thing. If you're expecting me to like break down retention or, you know, funnel analysis or all that stuff, that's really not this conversation, but we can totally talk about it. I want to make this a lot more conversational. Do we have the first slide?
We
do
have the first slide.
Okay, yeah, never mind. Don't worry about it.
Sorry about that.
Oh, good. The first slide was actually a great illustration of a product that went wrong. And I'll just describe it because the story goes, and there was a map. The map actually has California as an island, right? Now, that was created because of only a very few data points in the 16th century of one person coming down from the Straits of San Juan in Seattle. Another person coming up from Baja, they stopped before they got to the end, turned around, and went back to Spain. Right. That map was used for 300 years. Now, I would, as a product manager, I'd say that's a bad product because you use two data points to extrapolate what happened throughout the rest of, like, for 300 years in most of Europe, what was the benchmark for how you actually got around and thought about California. Right. And that really goes to the point, the heart of, like, what does it mean to be data driven? And this is where I'm going to ask you guys, you know, for the next few minutes, you know, please take some time to think about it. Open outcry. What does it mean to be data driven? Right. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, before you dive into data, you got to think about what are you looking for? What's your
yep.
goal?
Mm-hmm.
And then go out there and get the data and see if it actually is for your hypothesis.
Yep. Of course, yeah.
Let's say it's like an intuition, but it's, you know, that's people are driven by intuition of what they feel.
Uh-huh.
I think the data driven is now what are the numbers? What do they say?
Mm-hmm. So. Okay. Data driven versus the numbers. Yep. Sorry, say again?
It's something based on the data. It's about taking decisions.
Uh-huh.
With the data you have. Maybe strategy decision making.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Others? Other folks? Yep. Yep. Other? Yep. Uh-huh. Okay. So when you say tests, what do you mean? Can you talk, expand on that a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So then the data has meaning kind of before you get it, otherwise it might just be noise.
Okay. Uh-huh. Others? Yep. Excellent. Folks?
Targeting the right users.
Okay. All right. Others? Yep.
Data is going to be stationary. So it evolves, there's technology,
patterns,
changing pace.
Okay. Others? Anyone else? All right, great. This is actually a great list, and we're going to cover a lot of those topics during this chat. So before I get into the chat, I'm really going to give you a little bit more detail about me. So for anyone who's an aspiring product manager who is non-technical, I'm non-technical. My bachelor's degree is in political science. I have an MBA. I came from finance and consulting, right? The thing about data, and so I head up the data platform, which is all, as I mentioned, behavioral data for EA. Data is a language, just like accounting, just like English that I'm speaking to you right now. And actually, how you define that, and then also the relationship you draw, you know, it's essentially a value in a spreadsheet, just like Excel, right? Now, that's different than actually building credibility with your stakeholders, whether that's your customer, whether that's your engineer, your designer, your VP, or whomever. And that also is a different language in terms of how you actually use data to talk about and make the points you're talking about, right? So some of the stuff that my team, so I lead a team of 6 product managers. We work with a team of about 100 engineers. We create things like recommendation systems, experimentation systems, real-time targeting and segmentation tools for our players so that our marketers would use, and also multi-channel messaging. So if you think about our games, how many people have played an EA game in the past? Okay, great. The times when you receive 5 emails of the same promotion from us, that's a bad outcome, and that's why we design these systems, right? Or to say, hey, yeah, you know, you play The Sims, if you're familiar with The Sims, but oh, go buy Battlefield, which is one of our first-person shooter games, and you don't like shooters, that's also a bad outcome because your player experience is degraded by the fact that we don't know who you are to us, right? So that's really the systems we focus on. Now, before I worked on this, I actually joined EA through Playfish, which is a social games company a few years ago. It was on Facebook, a lot of games there, and I was both marketing as well as product because I was actually working with them to define the features that went into the games that helped drive a marketing P&L. So what are we talking about today? So yes, we are talking about, number one, defining data, right? So basically, what are we talking about? How are we being specific about what we mean by data, right? The next is, okay, who are you talking to? Who is your customer, not only in the end user sense, but also in the organization as you're talking to different people, right? What is important, right? And that's, you know, all of these questions are very basic product questions. You could actually write a PR, you can use these same exact questions to write a PRD. We're gonna talk about it from the context of data, but really what is important when you're talking about data? What could go wrong? And then just kind of some wrap up and conclusions, right? Throughout the entire chat, please feel free to ask questions as we go. And we can also use the whiteboard for illustrations, examples, and so on and so forth. All right. Okay, so first, measuring DAU. This is just a real quick example. This is, by the way, these are all war stories. They're real examples. I can give you all the background on it. Like, names have been changed and places have been changed to protect the innocent. But this is all real stuff. So 3 different levels of DAU. Look at it and just throw out random ideas as to why these DAU numbers are different. So we got one that's 10,000, one that's just a hair, like around 7,000, and one that's, you know, 3,000 or so. Sorry? Okay, definition of active. Now, can you actually drill into that a little bit? Like, how would that definition be? Okay, so launch. This activity. All right. Other hypotheses? Yeah.
Is it the same product?
Yes, it is the same product.
Over time.
Okay. It's not necessarily a time series, but it is from the same product.
Different segments.
Okay. Uh-huh. Others? Other hypotheses? Yep.
Time zone.
Okay. Others? Okay. Others?
Yeah. Well, errors.
Uh-huh.
And also what else has happened in the marketplace, right? It's a new product, either from your company or somewhere else, and it sucked away all the users.
Okay. These are all great hypotheses. Actually, what it is it really the definition of what login is. So this example comes from one of our largest games. Millions of users every single year, about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, right? What we discovered was when we define what is the data, what is login that we're using to calculate DAU, well, we found 3 things. Number one, when you authenticate, when you log into our service, there's one login right there. Now, but the other thing is, okay, all of our games, they have their own clients, right? And when you actually have a client, you opt into our terms of service, you have the option to opt out. So what this initial difference is from 10,000 to 7,000 is 30% of the people opt out because they don't want to give evil EA your personal information, right? The last one is specific, and this is going back to marketing as well as the product management. There was one team that actually operates a live service online version of the game, and all they care about is who logs into their game server. Now, the challenge of this is when you go up to finance, when you go up to your executive, in this case, the GM of the studio, when you actually provide analysis about this, when these three numbers don't match, those people get very angry. So really, this goes down to the heart of really defining what the data is. So when I started out as a product manager, I came in, I was like, hey, we're going to do these crazy segmentation, customer targeting tools, because as a marketer, that's what I really wanted. I came in, I realized, okay, you know what? That's actually going to be very, very difficult unless you have a foundation for telemetry, for semantic definition of what each individual thing is. And we spent literally the last 2 years, because we have games on our HD consoles like Xbox and PS4. We also have games on mobile, to create standards for what is login. Everything now actually comes in, and the only thing we're counting is through the authentication server, right? All this other stuff, one, this is gonna be missing data. That's too specific to the specific needs of that game. This is the front door for everyone when you log in, right? And that's really necessary as the foundational piece to actually do any other analysis downstream from that. Does it make sense? Any questions around this process? Because I know there was a question up front in terms of telemetry. This is an incredibly hard, painstaking process. This requires, depending on the size of your organization, walking around talking to marketing, talking to your designers, talking to your engineers especially, because what will happen is oftentimes when you send that event through, you know, they'll say, hey, here's the event structure. And they will say, okay, no, that payload is too big for what, you know, for my clients. I'm going to just change some of the parameters or not use some of them because it's easier. It's easier for me to implement, and it'll be easier on the load of my client to send through to you. But what that means is that if every single product or every single engineer does that and makes that different choice, again, you're not matching. You'll still be called login. But, you know, in the case of EA, you will have player levels. Someone will say PLY_LVL. Someone will say PLYR_LV. Those differences actually cause your analytics systems to break down stream, right? Questions? All right. So the other key thing about this is, who are you talking to? All right, so one of the things that we produce are recommendation systems. So, you know, paint the scenario and see if you guys have ever experienced this. You're talking to your engineer about, hey, I've got this great recommendation scenario. They say, holy cow, we've got 300 million users. In order for us to actually recommend stuff, we have to remember what they saw before, right? That's going to be really expensive. That's going to be, you know, let's say $3 million in terms of the overall budget we're going to have to spend on just storing that data. And the head engineer is going to say, holy cow, that's way too much relative to our overall budget, right? We can't do that. You're going to go to the executive. They're going to say, oh my God, that's way too expensive. You know what? That's way too expensive as well. You're going to go to the marketer though, and they're going to say, wait, hold on a second. We have 300 million people coming through our product. What are you doing? You're going to come in, you give them a bad experience at the end of the day. That's really, really horrible, right? Now, I leave these two down there at the bottom because that's really the key of it, right? Going back to your segmentation understanding, that scenario I just painted for you guys, trying to weigh the cost versus the customer experience, you know, how do you guys think you would address that problem, right? Any thoughts or any suggestions right off the bat?
Yep. You have to model what's the benefit. You've got the cost side of it. Mm-hmm. You've got to model the benefit. If for that $3 million, you only earn an extra $1.97, not so good. Instead, you can make a convincing case, do some testing, that you're going to make an extra $300 million, uh-huh. Like, then it becomes a no-brainer. So if you have choices, you need an outcome model.
Uh-huh. Model it out. Yep. Other thoughts?
Do it fast.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Other thoughts?
Yeah, as a marketer, I would be thinking, I have 309 people, so each of them, another one thing, it's like 600 million sales, it's about 300 million. I would definitely be arguing for it, and I would run a test to do it, but I think if you make, say, a
Mm-hmm.
You can probably extrapolate that behavior across everybody else.
Okay. Other thoughts? Yep.
How many pennies or fractions of pennies for each user?
Uh-huh. And then I'll set that against ARPU or RPPU. Yep.
That can potentially loss of revenue by other.
Okay. Other thoughts? All right. So with this, all that stuff is great, but that all requires you to take it to market. There's actually some very basic things that we did, because this case came up 3 weeks ago at my work. Number one, what is the distribution of people who will come back after a month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months? What we found is that what the marketer was asking for was, hey, we need to keep everyone's knowledge for a year, right? Because that is, you know, our games ship on a yearly cycle. If we miss the holidays, we miss Christmas time, we miss all these different things, we're not going to hit. And not a year, but specifically 13 months, because we have to be able to track year on year. The engineers are like, oh my God, that's going to be, you know, 300 million times whatever nodes, and the number got very, very big. All we needed to do was actually look at the distribution of the telemetry we already have, that login stat we just saw, and say, hey, if you've churned out, what is likelihood you're going to come back, and what percentage of different segments, the overall population, the spending population, et cetera, come back? And what we found is after 60 days, 5% of everyone comes back, and like half of 1% of spenders come back, because hey, you've got skin in the game. You're not going to just go away for 60 days unless you really, really are just done playing the game, right? Now, through that, you're able to then make that case to the executive saying, hey, yes, what we can do is we can actually save for a year the people who were spent, right? Just to make sure we capture and treat those players well. For everyone else, if it's 5% is too high, then we can go out 90 days and it drops down to 2-1%, and we can do 90 days for the remainder. But that enables you then to actually have multiple choices and options as a product manager around that type of messaging. Now, how many of you guys have free products versus how many have paid products? Just quick raise of hands. Free products? Okay. Paid products? Okay. How many guys who are paid have provided free or demo products? Okay, got it. Question to you guys. Do you notice a difference in your behavioral analytics of people who went in their free state versus their paid state in your demo or your free product?
Absolutely.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, the conversion rate is really low right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think from my perspective, the people who are looking at our free version is really a different segment of people who are using the paid version.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly right. That's what we've seen as well, right? We have a variety of different free products. We have, hey, you can subscribe to Xbox Network and we'll give you early access to some of our games before you even buy, right? There are just free demos, a beta. You can download it on PlayStation and then play our beta, and we use that as a way to communicate with the community, address bugs, and also give you an early view into the game. What we found across the board is that is incredibly useful for us to understand how people are playing the game. But people do not make the same decisions, right? And you see that in online poker. You see that across the board. When you have no skin in the game from a payment perspective, you will make completely different decisions than when you're actually paying for the product, right? So that's why when you actually think about, okay, who are you talking to when you're using your data? This is key, right? Any questions around this type of stuff? Happy to kind of spend more time on this and talking about how you position, how you actually manage different conversations throughout your... No? Okay. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Sure.
I used to play paid game.
Uh-huh.
So it depends. I didn't spend too much money. In the end, for the amount of emotional and financial engagement that we had, there was bad feedback, or there were cheaters, and you know, all those bugs were ending up. They eventually deterred me from coming back for the market as a paid customer.
Yes.
So that single painful experience has made me, in this case, more like shy of spending money, because first of all, it's not very open. Secondly, I
may get involved with it, but then there is always a possibility of cheaters.
Yeah.
And how do you, unless I'm confident that this problem will be solved, I'm reluctant to come back to the data.
Yeah, exactly. And that actually leads to this next part. How many people know this chart? It's from Boston Consulting Group. It's about the lifecycle of a product. Yeah, a lot of decent number of folks. Your question is exactly right, right? Because what you're talking about is here. You're already engaged. This is a product that's probably successful, has a large community. You're one of those paying customers. That's a different set of data questions than when you're actually trying to either launch the product, acquire new users, ramp up, or otherwise, right? And I've seen this actually happen at several in several teams at EA where you pay attention to the wrong problems. When you actually have a relatively mature cash cow product that's doing really, really well, if you're not actually paying attention to fraud and bots and things that are actually negatively impacting the player experience, you're probably missing out. If you're thinking, oh, no, I still need to juice that ARPU up a little bit more, and you overly focus on getting new people in and you're not treating the existing veterans well, that can lead you in the wrong direction. The key point here is that at each stage of the product lifecycle, there are completely different product questions you want to ask. You know, before you even launch the title, you're going to be looking at your acceptance criteria. What are your SLAs? What is the load you expect on the system? What's your adoption curve look like? So then you can actually provision, you know, the backend systems to be able to accept that load. Those are also data questions. When you're acquiring, obviously, you know, cost of acquisition and how much you're spending on Facebook or other channels to actually bring people in, how people discovery and the rate of conversion, etc. Those are questions that happen here. As you're trying to grow, obviously, it's looking at retention. How long are people sticking around? And then what is the conversion, right? And how are we actually managing that process and bringing people up the life cycle, trying to remove those roadblocks? Obviously, as we just talked about the cash cow, that's okay. You have a core user group. How are you preserving their experience so that they're not leaving, right? Because if you have critical mass and you're actually doing really, really well, yes, let's say 60-40, you divide some of that your bandwidth into, okay, well, how do you get more people in? Because everyone has a life cycle to stick around. You need to look at the churn in your population. But then how do you actually make sure that that population is stable? And then after the fact, when it's actually in decline, that frees you up actually to do a lot more experimentation. And you might actually discover a completely new niche or completely new aspect of your product that you innovate on and actually take in a different direction, right? Any questions around that or anyone want to share experiences? Yeah. Uh-huh.
Quick question. So,
sure. I mean, I think that you will segment people depending on what your business model is and what your customer and what your player base looks like, right? So yes, if you are, if you're presenting to an executive at different stages, yes. If you're asking them, for example, one story is, hey, I'm going to ask my executive, my CEO, whatever, for money for paid acquisition. Yes, you will say, okay, yeah, this is what we expect to get, et cetera, right? And this is the population. This is, you know, the rough breakdown geographically, what we expect their pay. This is what payback looks like, that sort of stuff. Later on, you'd be saying, okay, yeah, this is why we're going to be actually doing these features for your long-term user base because it's really good for them. We expect retention to increase this much, you know, overall ARPU is supposed to rise, that sort of thing. But it really depends on the context of the conversation you're having, right? By the way, I'm throwing out a lot of different acronyms. I know a lot of you are probably familiar with them. Are people not familiar with terms like ARPU, payback, et cetera? ARPU is average revenue per user. And there are a couple other funny acronyms. There's ARPPU, which is average revenue per paying user, or ARPS, average revenue per spender. They all basically mean, okay, how much do I make per capita for my entire app, product, et cetera, and how much do I get from the people who actually spend, right? Other questions around, yeah, uh-huh. That's an excellent question. Uh-huh. So, I mean, that really depends if you're talking mobile or on console, right? Because up front, mobile is very, very difficult because the problem is discovery. There's so many apps that are launched on your app stores on any given day, let alone week, month, year, et cetera, right? So, I mean, a lot of those metrics are prefaced on, okay, well, how much are we actually getting promotion from Apple or from Google to actually launch this title? Is there a license associated with it? Is it a FIFA game, a Madden game, or et cetera? And what type of acquisition do we expect from association with that brand, right? And then it becomes, okay, within that first, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, or, well, actually, let me step back. For a lot of our mobile titles, which I'm sure is similar for a lot of your products, we go through soft launch phases where we test in small markets to see what adoption looks like. And then we'll actually start rolling out globally based on, and we'll also do closed betas too, to say, okay, is the core loop, are the key features that we're providing, and test those out as well. So a lot of that happens in advance of a full blown, hey, it's featured on the App Store style launch, right? Now, if you're talking console, that's different. People are pointing at $60. It might not even be them buying. It might be their grandparent over Christmas time buying out of Best Buy. So that's a completely different funnel, which is much more like traditional retail. And that's the success of that is very much more nuts and bolts. Hey, we're paying this much to put it on a disc and put it in a store or give a digital download code. This is what payback needs to look like in the 12, 16, 18 month time frame for us to decide whether it's a success or not. Make sense? Other questions? Yeah. I could tell you, but that'll cost you money. No, that is entirely dependent on your product, right? I mean, I think that it is a, like, you know, we've all seen small underfunded products that like absolutely explode. And all the ones that are launched by either huge brands or very, very well funded fall completely flat on their face. I don't know the answer to that one. Yeah, go ahead.
So my project is in a very early stage.
Uh-huh.
What would you consider the 5 most important
So it really depends on the product, but there are a couple of basic things I think from a product management perspective. Number one, can you ship? Is it going to go out the door? Number two, is it, if it, once it goes out the door, is it stable? What's your uptime? Exactly. Number three, okay, based on, you should have some sort of projection on load, but have you provisioned enough in your back end to actually be able to support that load? Number four, what is the velocity of development you actually have? Because you're going to get it out there, and hopefully you're going to be beta testing it with a small group of players. How quickly can you address their concerns? Because if you actually see any big deal breaker feature bugs, how quickly can you fix that? Now, I'm sure there are a lot of product managers here. Do you guys have other thoughts in terms of, hey, as we're developing a product, what the first few metrics should be that you're looking at? Yeah. Uh-huh.
Which I think it's awesome that you said you get.
Yeah.
It's sustainable. Usually people talk about like working with the faction of laughing attention, all that kind of stuff. But it's great to get more users, but if you can't access lots of things to them, you probably won't get another chance.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's the same thing as, you know, as the product management process, you know, what gets taught at product school. Like, it's an iterative process, just like this talk, right? You got to constantly. Yeah, exactly. Thanks. Well, I mean, did that help answer your question? Okay. Are there other people who wanted to share different viewpoints? Totally happy to listen to those as well. Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things about, so let's say you've actually found something that's really, really, that you found a niche that where your product speaks to that niche and it's growing. Then it really is, okay, how do you then engage with the core customer base and understand those needs and then add the features that will really expand and enhance that process. At that point though, again, it really does become, okay, well, what is the velocity of that growth, right? So do you have the scalability built into your process to be able to address that? Do you also have then the velocity of development in your, you know, in whether you guys using Agile and story points or otherwise, do you know that you can actually address those features in a timely way before people churn out? Because what you then want to understand is, okay, based on what you've got ground floor, what is the average lifespan of a person who comes into your product? Why are they engaged? How long are they engaging? If it's conversion, why are they spending? How long and how much do they spend on average, right? So that, to his point, right, once you're into a growth mode where you actually, hey, the product works, it's found some sort of a niche, then it's about, okay, well, let's think about this as a live service and what do we need to do to retain people, to understand what they're looking for, why they like the product that they've got, and then kind of keep it going from there. Make sense? Thanks very much for the question. Other questions or other perspectives? Okay. Your marketer comes to you and says, we just ran a test. I'm not sure what it means, but we ran a test. What should we do? What do you want, as a product manager, what do you want to do? Any thoughts on that? Yeah. Okay. How would you do that? Okay. other thoughts, other questions?
I was probably asking a question like, what did you do?
Yeah, exactly.
Did you run? What were your assumptions? Like, what was your scope?
Yep.
Like, what did you actually do?
Got it. Okay. Yeah. No, that exactly. Other thoughts?
It came from marketing.
It came from yes. It came from marketing. He said, hey, we ran it. We threw something. We put a new feature out. And we did a test. We got some results back.
So based on what you plan, the initial audience, uh-huh. and you are kind of like not to communicate it to another audience,
mm-hmm.
maybe executives.
Okay, so you want to take this? You would take this to executives?
No.
Okay.
The point is, they came to you with something. You have to synthesize it to present it to someone else.
Yes. Uh huh. Yep. Uh huh. Other. Huh? Well, see, we ran an analysis based on the geographies of our customers, and you know, and they're, and this is the sales data we got back, right? Yeah.
I would ask what decisions, what choices are you trying to make?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's usually the first thing. I mean, because a test, you know, itself doesn't mean anything. It's a question of how does it make your choice between A, B, or C.
Okay, so we said, like they said, okay, yes. Well, we're looking at the verticals of geographies. We ran our promotion, and we're trying to lock in our projections for revenue for the next 12 months based on this. Okay. So, hey, if I sell a lot in some of these geos, it'll be great. Yep. Uh-huh. Question in the back.
It's important to know if they have stored data before test and after test.
Uh huh.
And if they have stored data for test group and data for group which didn't have test.
So a control and a variant. Yeah. Is everyone familiar with the scientific method? You guys laugh, but I was having a conversation. So one of the things that I found as building experimentation platforms is actually a lot of people don't have a good understanding of what that means when we say the scientific method. Yes, we all learned it in high school or in elementary school or whatnot, but when you're talking about giving people an A/B testing tool, how to set up a proper control, how to set up a proper variant, and how to identify what the independent and dependent variables are, that actually requires quite a bit of education, right? Because what this person will come back and say is, hey, okay, actually, you know what? Chew was the wrong dimension for my analysis. I ran the wrong query. It actually looks more like that, right? Now, those are seven dots in a row because they'll run it against, you know, date as opposed to geo. So they're saying, okay, now I've got it. We have a correlation here. These last three or four days, we clearly sell more. We know what the pattern is now. We're gonna build our forecast out for 12 months and say we're gonna make this much money based on the data we're seeing. Any questions around this or thoughts on how you would then what you would do with this stage of analysis?
I want to ask what kind of hidden variables you're missing right there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, hidden variables. Yep. Other thoughts? No other thoughts? Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh.
If I understand what you're saying, they fished around until they found, in the data, they found some correlation or some pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And I've forgotten my staff 101, but my understanding is that's often a very dangerous way to go about things, is that you mm-hmm. need to kind of set the test up before. If you just fish for in any data set, even random numbers, you'll find some wacky correlations between, you know, how much a giant's win and your sales, or some weird, crazy thing. But you need to set up the test with beforehand with the appropriate samples that are independent and the control group and the other group. And if you fish in reverse, then you've got no way to test your hypothesis.
Yeah, so I mean, so that's exactly right. When we talk to marketers, and I used to be a marketer, so I'm not casting aspersions. A lot of what they'll say is, hey, we know, okay, telemetry, you don't need to do any tracking. No, we don't need experimentation. We'll just back test. We'll just reverse engineer and find the patterns, and that'll be okay. To the person who made the comment around controls and variants, that's not really okay, because how are you going to control how people were exposed? What were the circumstances by which they saw the thing that you're trying to test, right? So to your point, experimental design is actually really essential when you're talking about being data-driven, because you can say you ran a test, but if it's the test, there can be temporal, you know, I'm going to show someone something to someone on Tuesday and then show it to a different group on Friday. But how do you control for the population, the size, the significance of the population relative to how, you know, both the control as well as the experimental group, right? Thank you. Other questions or comments? So basically their thought is, hey, we've got this pattern, you know, based on the sales numbers for, you know, we tested for, looks like what, 5 weeks, 35 days. That's statistically significant. And a 35 is great, you know, it's a decent size. So we're going to base all of our forecasts on that, right? So then you go back and you say, okay, this is the time where they actually looked at your revenue forecasts. Thanksgiving all the way straight through to Christmas. And we're going to take that 1 month and we're going to then extrapolate that out to say every month we're going to sell as much as we can. Do you think there might be problems with the revenue forecast in this case? Okay. So the whole point about why this is important is because, you know, it really, that experimental design, just saying, you know, to your point, now when I asked you earlier on during introduction, what is a test? Defining what that space is incredibly essential because you can actually pull out and bake in confounding factors like the fact that it is Black Friday through to Christmas without even knowing it unless you actually ask those questions like you were talking about early on. Any questions around that? All right. You guys have been on this page, right? Daily, today's deals from Amazon. Rough estimate, and apologies for everyone in the back who can't see it. How many tests do you think roughly are running on this page right now? Yeah, by the way, I don't actually have a count on it, but other thoughts? I just kind of want to get people's thoughts on this. Yeah. Yep. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. The category that the items are arranged in the menu.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the category of what three things gets presented there.
Yep. So rather recommendation, uh-huh.
And they know who you are.
Yes.
So there's probably some testing about what they present to whom.
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, no, yeah, that's exactly right. Another thing that list is great. Another thing that you didn't mention is after product discovery, because this is my daily deals page. So just a little background. It's my daily deals page. What did I say before? What? Oh yeah, product discovery. Yeah, because if this is just living in Amazon's vastness of millions of pages, you know, why would I find these three things other than what was recommended on this page? So background on this. I recently had a baby, so I'm in the need of a shiatsu massager because my shoulders are constantly hunched over taking care of the baby. In-laws are coming into town a lot, so I recently bought an air mattress. And, you know, as part of it, I like talking, but I also like reading about different management approaches. So why is Good to Great featured as a book for me? Because I like management science and reading about management science. So yes, you're exactly right. These are my recommended product selections. But to your other point, yes, deal of the day, the order in which they're presented, the price, how the price is represented. Is it a slot? Is it struck through with 60% off or is it a price range? You know, all of this stuff. There's, you know, there are probably, yes, easily dozens of tests here. But the thing is, for most of us who aren't Amazon, this is going to be way too complicated. By the same token, there are going to be certain points in your product lifecycle where you're just going to need to make money. So trying to control everything down to, I'm going to move one thing at a time, might not be the right decision. That goes back to the earlier slide around, hey, who are you talking to? What is the stage? What is the life cycle of your product? What is really important right now? Because if you want to break it down to this and say, hey, what we need is we want to build an experimentation platform. It's going to be awesome. I'm going to handle multiple variables at once, be recommendations, all this other stuff. That's a great vision. But if you're just trying to get the product out the door and figure out if there's a fit, probably not the best thing. Maybe go out and, you know, this is not a plug by any means, but there's, you know, Split.io, there's Lean Plum, there's Swerve, there's Optimize, all these different ways you could actually run tests. Might not need to actually build a platform for it. And also, if you're going to be building a platform, maybe start small. Questions around that? Yeah, uh-huh. So there are a couple of different approaches. So I mentioned multivariate testing, right? Which is different than multivariant, which most people call ABN. So there's confusion there sometimes. And I just want to clarify that. Multiple variants means, hey, I've got a control and I've got A, B, and C variants, right? Multivariate means I have the ability to, and there are a lot of different approaches to this, test the different variables in conjunction to actually test effectiveness, right? There's marketing, they actually have what they call conjoint analysis, right? When they go through and like, for the easiest example is the features you buy in a car. When they offer you package A, B, and C, right? They'll look at, okay, what are the relative correlations between the features and what people convinces people to buy, and then that's how they create the packages, right? So there is multivariate testing to enable that. Yeah. Other questions? All right. But yeah, that goes back to what could go wrong, right? You could just have bad data. That goes back to, you know, login and everything that happened. Oh, by the way, do you know who this is? Anyone? Yes.
Feynman.
Yes.
And he's holding up a O-ring.
Yes. Yeah. Do you know why I put this up here, guys? Do you know? So this is a really famous historical, and this shows that I'm old, example. So basically, this was a press conference with when Congressional Oversight Committee was going through and they hire scientists to say, why did Challenger explode? Right. Has anyone ever heard of Edward Tufte? Okay, he uses this example all the time. What ended up, and this is his diatribe against PowerPoint, actually. Basically, the aeronautical engineers who designed the solid rocket booster for Challenger, do you guys all know the Challenger accident? Okay. That's okay. Who was born before the Challenger accident? No, you don't have to raise your hand. But essentially what happened was, okay, so the engineers down at the ground level, this is also one of the things that you need to struggle with, who you're talking to and how they're communicating. They said, hey, at low temperatures, the O-ring that actually seals the joints between the two sections of the solid rocket booster, they have a tendency to get a little bit brittle. They don't rebound and expand back to their original shape as quickly as they should. That was buried three or four levels of bureaucracy down, and then it got boiled up and boiled up and boiled up, so that when it came up to the leadership of NASA, that was wiped out. That was wiped out at like the second or third tier. What Feynman did is a very basic example. He took a piece of that O-ring, he put a winch on it, and then dropped it in, a caliper, and dropped it into a glass of ice water during the press conference. Pulled it out, took the caliper off, and showed that there was a massive dent in that O-ring and that it was not expanding quickly enough. So what ended up happening with Challenger, for anyone who doesn't know, is that because they took off on a very, very cold morning, when it got up to a point where the barometric pressure changed, fuel began leaking through that gap in the O-ring, and it caused that solid rocket booster to explode, right? So when I bring this up as an example of what could go wrong, that's one of those things where have you actually had the conversation like about all the things that could go wrong? Is your data valid? Are you talking around about the same metric and the same event? What is noise, right? What is the baseline? That's why we need to have a control. What is the baseline noise you see in the system so you can actually control for that, right? Seasonality, someone brought that up earlier, and that was the core of my example in the previous example. Hey, if it's Christmas time, if it's summertime, if it's, you know, how does that impact? And there are, other than seasonality, there are tons of other factors that would play into, you know, how your product performs on specific days. Is it the Super Bowl? Is it World Series, et cetera? Are there false positives? You could just be seeing something that just came out of nowhere, right? Has no significance in the long run. It just happened because when you ran that test, something happened. And then also, what are the other confounding factors that you're not aware of yet? So whenever you, even after you run a test, right, even if you have that data and that conclusion, test it again. Test it a few different places. Make sure that you can actually validate that it really is happening, right? Now, again, this all is in the context of where you are in your product lifecycle. If you just need to make money, which is important, making money, this might not be the right approach, but maybe it is. And that's really a conversation you need to have based on those stakeholders, based on what you're trying to accomplish. Make sense? All right, Hachi, how are we doing on time? Oh, okay, cool. So in conclusion, you know, overall, define your data properly. Remember who you're talking to, both in the audience, externally as the customer, what segment, but also what segment of your own organization, your own company you're talking to, right? Identify what is important at what stage and for what reason, right? It's no good focusing on acquisition when you've got a leaky, you've got a hole in the bottom of your retention bucket and no one's actually sticking around. If you've spent a lot of money trying to get them in and they fall right out the bottom, not helpful. And then were the results tested and validated? Did you go through and make sure that you're controlling out for other factors? Did you actually make sure that the data is clean? All those types of things we talked about. And then also make sure that you're going through and checking for anything else that have gone wrong, because there always will be. And, you know, we're all working in a space that's moving quickly, live service. Things are always going to be changing. So it's always test and iterate. All right. So thanks very much for this time, and we'll move into Q&A. All right. Thanks. All right. Questions? Yeah.
You mentioned you have up to 6 product managers and about 100 engineers.
Yeah.
How many people do you have dedicated to collecting data or going out, maybe doing interviews or just working on the data collection part?
The data collection part. So our entire platform collects data. So we collect, when I talked about a data platform, basically what it is we absorb all the data from all the games. So when you do something in our game, they basically send us a telemetry event. We receive it, we store it, we process it into a metric like DAU, right? In terms of how much data we collect about 8 to 10 terabytes a day. Overall data size is about 15 petabytes or so. So, you know, decent sized, but not the largest by any extent. But are you talking about data from the customer for the products?
I think I asked that incorrectly.
Okay.
Do you do any like interviews?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, I think one of the things that is most important about, so EA is a large company. And sometimes I wish I were still worked for a startup. But one of the key things is actually how you collect the data and from whom, right? So one of the things I work with my product managers on is, okay, who is important in the organization and why? How are they making decisions? And then how strong is your relationship with them, right? Because the goal for them is to, one, build trusted relationships for the people who actually can make the decisions and help understand and socialize or move forward our mission and our vision, right? And in those cases, those are key customers for us, right? Because they're either early adopters who pilot something and we have quick wins from a functional perspective, or they're influential because they have their large successful games that, you know, if they adopt, everyone else will then fall in line, that sort of thing, right? The other thing is actually when we talk about how we collect data is also understanding not just data that's collected, but what is the action we intend to take, right? So in a large scale matrix organization, what you're talking about is, okay, well, how do you navigate those tiers of the hierarchy to make sure that if you have an insight, it gets acted upon? And that's really when, after the product manager creates a product, we have success, we're moving the adoption curve, is okay, well, just like selling, who's the inside salesperson you actually need to talk to actually convert? Because without that and understanding, hey, a lot of my team, sometimes junior product managers struggle with, hey, I'm only talking to, from a telemetry standpoint, right? I'm only talking to the software engineer who's implementing, you know, and I can't make any progress. And you have to tell them, okay, no, actually, you need to figure out how to get 2 or 3 layers up to the decision maker and come back down and make sure that everyone up and down is aligned to actually move the thing forward, right? Hopefully that provides a little bit of context. Other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, I have a question. So I actually built your intern. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what would be the best way to collect data for like physical products.
So do you sell furniture, physical product in a physical store or online? Okay. Okay, sure. I mean, do you have a bell when people come through the door?
We have 5 customers a day.
5 customers a day?
Exactly. Well,
over half, so 5 customers a day, but that's decent.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
it's in Ecuador, right?
Uh-huh.
And it's a high-end retail store, so a lot of attention to your clients, they get a designer and stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I actually studied that data analytics, so it's kind of frustrating when you don't get much data.
Got it.
Because so every time you try to do a survey, like, you don't want, like, it gets kind of awkward.
Oh, really? So you an in-person survey, or do you send an email with, like, is everyone familiar with, like,
a lot of stuff. So usually when I'm in the store, I click towards a lot in the store talking to the client.
Uh-huh.
And then when the product is delivered, I have a survey for clients to fill out and give some information. But I still haven't gotten like any significant, like I've had like 20 answers, something like that.
Okay, got it. I mean, and then do you actually, so how many questions in the survey?
5.
Oh, wow. And you only get 20 answers. I mean, that's a good question.
How
yeah.
do you do when people are not giving you data?
Well, so I mean, so there's a couple of things. So in Ecuador, I'm not sure what type of market research firms that are out there. I mean, you can always get a market research survey of some kind. Do you go, I mean, there's, you know, influencers are really popular right now. Do you actually go to places where they might talk about luxury design? Do you talk to the designers? Do you talk to the, do you move up the funnel in terms of people who could actually be influencers for, to come into your store?
Yeah, we do that.
Okay. Okay.
I've tried everything.
Yeah. So, I mean, what problem, this sounds like we might want to take it offline, to dive a little bit deeper into the conversation, but I'm happy to talk to you more about it later. Uh-huh. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
So you don't have the capacity of, for example, in a small startup.
Uh-huh. On the analysis side. Oh, that's a good question.
I don't know. I'm imagining a person who has a lot of experience in this field that can sort of consult.
So first of all, it would be actually there's a lot of Google searching, so you can make sure you ask the right questions. And then oftentimes what I've found, and not just for product management, but just across the board, if you actually just talk to friends of friends or people you can reach out to on LinkedIn for a casual coffee, you can usually actually talk to them and get some insights, right? In addition to which, I mean, just like me coming to talk to you guys tonight or other places, I mean, there's times when people will voluntarily just say, hey, I'm happy to look at that for you, you know, and I keep it discreet. So one of the things, for example, my sister works for a large cosmetics company and they're thinking about a European expansion. And they're not sure how to actually price their product in Europe. So, you know, I have an MBA. I went to business school in London and I said, oh, you know, I'm going to put you in touch with my pricing professor. Also so happens that I've reached out to him and he's given me recommendations to talk to people when we've had game pricing challenges, right? Now, you know, there's a line between, hey, what's a good-natured casual ask versus, hey, this should be a consultancy type arrangement. But usually, you know, if you're upfront with them about it and don't overextend and try to kind of, you know, use them too much, the people are pretty open to helping. Hopefully that helps. Yeah. Other questions?
It's a question concerning the recommendation system. I'm trying to launch a project building up a recommendation system. So I made a prototype and ran a test. Was it recommendation versus editor manually picked issues? But the test results will show that it was getting the same counts of issues solved and the user finding it. So the test result didn't give me an insight to go for the system or not. In this case, how should I?
Okay, so there's a couple things. Well, pause for a station identification real quick. I forgot that I need to repeat the questions that were asked in the mic so people can hear. So the first question that was asked about how to actually drive more foot traffic in a physical retail store. Second question, which was asked, how do we actually, if you don't have that capability, you know, get some help with analysis. The third question is around recommendation systems. Basically, the person has a Web 2.0 product. She's tried to test with a recommendation system and didn't yield significant results. The first question I'm going to ask you is how many pieces of content were you recommending? Did they have to choose between?
It was basically three because people do not read many of the issues all the time. We think about maximum five or three a week. So it's a system.
Mm-hmm.
And when we are recommended by the system, people picked about 3 to 4. It was basically the same for the editor manual. They picked recommendations. So
yeah.
They picked 3 or 4.
Okay, got it. So real quick question here. How many people here in the audience actually work on recommendation systems or have them in their products? Just quick raise of hands. 2, 3. Okay, 3. And feel free to actually also respond. I think you're using too few items. What I found with the systems we use, so we basically use two different algorithms. One's called UCB1 and one's called Thompson Sampling. They're basic standard multi-arm banded explore and exploit style recommendation. I mean, it's used the same thing for web pathing to figure out what the right click path is. But it doesn't really work unless you have at least 40 or 50 things. from my experience, guys who actually have recommendation systems, any other feedback? You can disagree with me. You can say yes or otherwise. No? Yeah, uh-huh. No, not 450, 40 or 50. Yeah, so basically, to your point, if there's only 10 things, and depending on the traffic, it's not statistically significant. It's like going out to thinking about the experiment, right? I mean, you need something that's of a significant sample size where there's actually enough diversity in the population to be able to actually be representative of what you're doing. So I think that, I don't know the rest of the context, but it might just be you need more things to recommend. Yeah.
Okay, so we have time for two more questions.
Yep. Uh-huh, go ahead. Uh-huh.
At the same time, or like you present a sample of the 40 or 50 sets of 3 and 5, and you show all 40 or 50 simultaneously.
Oh, no. So sorry. The pool of content you want to pull from for a recommendation, yeah, rotate through. Yeah. Oh, really? Oh, okay. So there's the pool of content. Okay, got it. Interesting. Okay, actually, let's take that offline. I want to talk to you more about that after this. Okay. Yep. Huh?
So you told us that you have a lot of war stories. I assume it's a lot of data.
Yeah.
So a question for the group. So not one of those horrifying war stories ones, but one of those like beautiful sunshine moments I want you to describe.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about a time when you found that people behave differently from how you would expect it. Which is one of those ones like, oh, I would not have expected about that.
People behave differently than what I expected. Are you talking about our players or our people I engage with?
Yeah, I mean, like, what's the data that you're testing against? Like, what's the conversion rate? 50%? No. Like, it turns out to be 30%. No, no. It's like data you didn't expect to find out, find, and then you're like, that's interesting.
So this goes back to actually the question around, from the person sitting in front of you around the player experience. You're working with a game team. They have a very large live service community. And all we were trying to do was help them understand, okay, what's the velocity through their economy, right? If you're buying stuff, if you're looking at stuff, how do people convert? How do people they can actually trade stuff? And wanted to see that. What we identified was actually what you were complaining about, is that, you know, there's a market there and there's a lot of fraud. There's a lot of effectively money laundering going on in the system, right? And what was very surprising is that they then took that knowledge and we actually worked with them, our data science team worked with them to build a fraud detection algorithm based on what we call a lopsided trade, right? You know, a lopsided trade for everyone who doesn't know is, okay, you have a product that's worth $1, but you actually end up selling it to someone else for $10,000 because you're actually in cahoots and you just want to move money through the ecosystem, right? That works with any type of money laundering, right? So that was one of those discoveries where there's like, oh, okay, actually that really helps us, and they just jumped on board and really worked with us closely. Other questions?
All right, I actually am going to ask the last question. Sure. So we have many aspiring product managers in the building.
Yeah.
And as a future product school instructor / someone who made their way into the role, what advice do you have for our aspiring PMs about how to make it in?
Thick skin. No, 100%, right? As you know, basically, if you have a vision for what you actually want to do, right? The whole reason that I'm a product manager today is because I came from marketing, saw what we had in kind of a live service social environment, the tools, the approach, et cetera, looked around EA and said, hey, that doesn't exist yet. At that time, I had never even drawn a marketecture diagram, i.e. boxes and arrows, right? I was just like, but I know what needs to be built. So I went with that diagram and I went around to different people and I said, okay, the first place that this is going to have to happen is a data platform. And just said, hey, I have a vision for what needs to be built. I can learn the tools that I need to learn to bring this to fruition and build confidence that way. You do the same thing with selling, you do the same thing with finding a new job, a partner, et cetera, but just, you know, a thick skin and being able to actually constantly talk about what you're passionate about and convince people.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks very much, guys.